This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today are Professor Ed Madden from the University of South Carolina, who is also the Poet Laureate for the City of Columbia. And with him is Tim Conroy, and Tim is a budding poet. So first of all, gentlemen, welcome back to the Journal. It's a pleasure really to have you. Ed, you've been on the show before, but you were not the city's Poet Laureate. How did that all come about, and what do you have to do? When the mayor dedicates a new factory, have you got to write a poem?
It's not quite that specific a job. It started in January 2015. Fall of 2014, a group of people, Cindy Boyder from Muddy Ford Press and Jasper Magazine, and Lee Snellgrove from One Columbia for the Arts and History. They put together a committee to find a city laureate. The city council passed an ordinance of October 2014. And the ordinance basically says that I'm expected to have a poem for major occasions. So for each of the mayor's State of the City addresses in January, I've had a poem for those. And that I'm supposed to be available for libraries and schools, and I'm supposed to think of ways of promoting poetry as a public art. And then my own project sort of on top of that is just I want to think of ways of getting Columbia and South Carolina writing out there, like come up with venues, maybe venues you don't expect, and specifically ways of thinking about poetry as a public art. So, for example, my favorite thing we've done so far was last April. We did fake parking tickets downtown, and each of the parking tickets had a poem on it. We did it on a Saturday, which is Saturday, April 1st. So it was April Fool's Day, and it was also the beginning of National Poetry Month. And it was a hit. It was great fun.
What did the people do when they realized they had a or thought they had a parking ticket?
See, there were a lot of angry people at first, but this project got so much social media because then people were tickled, and some people were trying to collect all six poems because they realized there were different poems. People were posting it on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. It was a fun project.
Oh, that's interesting. I wasn't downtown on April Fool's Day, so I didn't get to. Okay. And Tim, when did you first start writing poetry?
You know, I've always sort of tried to write poetry, but I just never really took it seriously. It was something I did after work. I was pursuing a profession, and I was trying to be the best special education teacher I could be. I was trying to be the best educator I could be. And, you know, all that sort of changed when Pat died March 4th, 2016. Something clicked in me. I found with the clarity of loss, the urgency to write.
For those who don't know who Pat Conroy is, South Carolina's best known 20th and 21st century writer, who and Tim's older brother, who died in March of 2016. So you have quit your day job now and you're...
I've quit my day job, and I've tried to, seek the conviction it takes to write. I don't think this would have happened, and I don't think a book would have emerged without such a skilled editor as Ed Madden to help me along the way, to encourage me along the way, to get me to sort of seek truth rather than perfection.
The title of your collection of poems, Theologies of Terrain. Ed, in your introduction, you were analyzing Tim's poetry, and you talk about his involvement of nature.
Right. I mean, he already had a poem, which I loved, Theology of Terrain, and I had suggested it could be the title of the book, although we made it plural, theologies. And part of that was because I just felt like there was such a strong spiritual urgency to this book. In my intro, I call him a theologian of the ordinary, and I really think that's what this book does. It's about the daily and the practical and the material. In the introduction, I even point out that he's got two different kinds of cathedrals. He's got the established, predictable cathedral, which in his version is full of hypocrisies and people trying to outdo each other. And then there's the other cathedral, which is the Cathedral of the Forest. And he goes there for some kind of, and I'm not even sure truth is the right word there, but some kind of perspective.
And in fact, there is a line from that. The poem is titled Blessed. This first stanza is subtitled Eyelined. Hair frosted on a wooden pew, wrenching and kneeling, a pocketbook of judgment dressed in the latest salvation, wearing Anne Klein for Jesus, even the preacher eyelined. Everyone singing to the choir in a cathedral of glances. You need the unison, amen. In this house, success is a symbol of what God can do. The blessed repeat their prayer for the poor. Thank God it is not me. You want to explicate that for our listeners?
You know, I go back to the title, to Theologies of Terrain. And when Ed suggested to make it plural, it seemed so right to me because everybody has these places where places take on more meaning than you can ever imagine because they're connected with so much history, so much personal history and time.
But I think in this book, your places are more often than not the natural world.
Yeah, I think I derive a lot of comfort and a lot of solace from the natural world, getting out there and hiking. I know you love to take walks and places like the Congaree Swamp. I have a friend that I hike with on the Appalachian Trail, and it's one of the favorite things I do is to get out and take those extended trips on the trail and sort of get back into a space where there's quiet and mystery.
Given your family's history, and I think by now most people are familiar with the Conroy family history, either through Pat's writings or through the two shows that we did here with you and your siblings, talking about growing up with the great Santini. I read Assurances, which is the first poem. And yes, I see great Santini, and I see about you trying to please your father, and never really successfully. But that was true of your siblings as well. But I also got a hint of, is this a lesson you're teaching yourself about how a father should relate to his son?
You know, Walter, I think that's true. I wanted so much to have a poem that reflected my father in this book. And I wanted that to ring with authenticity. When I used to go up right after my father retired from the Marine Corps, I would travel up to Atlanta to see him. And we would take these ridiculous trips. He was working as a Pinkerton security guard, and we would go on these third shift trips to these warehouses, these vast warehouses in Atlanta, and he would tell me to get out of the car when he'd see a door open, check it out, Jocko, and I would have to get out, and so that poem kind of came from that memory, and I think you're right. You know, I think, you know, I struggle with the father I had, the mother I had, the father I wanted him to be.
I love that the book opens with that assertion, a son needs a father to answer. And I don't know, Tim, if you were thinking this way at all, but once it's put in the collection with the book, with the other poems, which have a more... or some of which have a more spiritual impetus, I can't help but think a son needs a father to answer. There's a bigger father, a bigger question that needs to be answered in this book as well.
You're talking about, again, we're talking about the poem Assurances. You want to please your father, and then you have an incident where basically you snooker him. You're going to investigate a warehouse, and you might find, you didn't say you always found, but you might find a homeless person cuddled up sleeping, smell of cheap liquor, and then you leave him alone, you shut the door, but you take a shot at your father. You say, smell cheap liquor, probably former Pinkertons or Marines, I believe. So you're looking at this down-and-out person. You're relating that to your dad.
You know, I saw what war can do to a military family whose father is going off to battle, and the difficulty that a father has integrating back into a family. And, you know, we saw that as a family together time and time again. And, you know, I felt like, and this is a familiar story, that really what saved, what redeemed my father was the honesty of the great Santini. When that novel came out, he had to come to terms with himself and how he had treated the family, and he had to come to a larger truth. And you know, that was really a gift to Dad. You know, Pat sort of saved Dad. You know, Dad could have been easily one of those folks in the warehouse who was drinking cheap liquor and passed out, because he sort of hit rock bottom after the divorce with my mom.
The whole poem is very gripping, what he says to you, but the final line, there are no assurances in this life. I think all parents may have some. With my girls growing up, it was, the world's not fair.
Well, he always wanted me to be tougher, to toughen up. And I was the kid that wasn't the toughest kid. You know, I was, you know, and so he always tried to get me to be a little tougher.
There were five of you boys, right? And he wanted you to be the tough one?
Well, he wanted me to be tougher because he knew I was, you know, he would tease me about being sensitive. And, you know, I, of course, you know, being a Conroy, the more he teased me about being sensitive, the more sensitive I actually became. So thank you, Dad.
Well, there's some yearning in that last line. You know, there are no assurances in this life. From my knowledge of Tim Conroy, I can't see you saying that. I can think of you wanting to put your arm around a child.
You know, I think you're right, Walter. I think that, you know, my inclination is that we all need to assure each other a lot more than we do. And what I would want a parent to do is to do what Ed did as the editor of this book. He assured me the whole way that this collection was going to happen, that the poems were good enough, that the editing process, the changes we were making, that I was considering and he was suggesting, were things that felt so right. It was a great working relationship.
All right, Ed, you've published any number of poetry. Do you have a poetry editor, someone who edits your books?
It's a couple of the presses, I had editors who made suggestions. I think particularly with my second book, Prodigal, the editor at that press made a number of suggestions, some of which I accepted and some of which I argued against. I will say, for me, this particular project was far more collaborative than I expected it to be. I mean, Cindy Border at Muddy Ford Press, her idea with this series is to get an established poet to work with an unpublished poet and help them put a book together to publish. And when I read Tim's poems earlier, I mean, I know, Tim, you used the language that these were good enough. I thought many of these are beautiful. I mean, what I said in my intro is that some of these just break me. I think they're just stunning poems. Our collaboration, or my suggestions, were more often than not, and Tim, you can say, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but more often than not, it was either cutting an ending or urging you to stick with the first story you wanted to tell. I remember one story about you lying, as a little boy, lying to a little girl, and you wanted to spin this poem out into some fanciful thing. And I'm like, no, like this human story is the poem. So I think more often than not, I was urging him to trust his original impulse, that the story he wanted to tell was a story that, should be told. And then the larger process was just thinking about the order of the book, what comes first, what should be the last poem, what poems should go together because they ring off each other in some way. So it was a delight.
I could not think of a better poem to start with than Assurances. I mean, that sets the groundwork because you have other poems that talk about this struggle with your father, your desire to please, and there are some pretty raw emotions in them. But you set the groundwork.
Our first meeting, you know, it felt so right. We had lunch at a restaurant in Columbia that happened to be in the building that my brother Tom committed suicide off of. Ed did not know this. We had walked over to have lunch, and we just ended up there. And I didn't even realize until about halfway through the lunch, it hit me that I was in that building.
That you were in the Cornell Arts building.
Yes, yes. And so go back to the title of the book. This building has meaning to me beyond belief. And when I see that building, you know, I have a flood of memories of a brother who I loved. And later, you know, fast forward to once the book is published, we have this great release party at Immaculate Consumption. And behind me, I'm standing sort of where the windows are, and behind me is the Cornell Arms, again, the building. And to me, it was it brought back this rush of, it's a tribute to Tom. It's a tribute to all those places in our lives that we have meaning, attach so much meaning. Pat used to call this the circle of life, where things come back around. And it was definitely one of those moments where things came back around.
Why don't you read Assurances for our listeners?
Would be happy to. Assurances. It comes to this. Will we be all right? A son needs a father to answer. For a few years after the colonel retired from the Marine Corps, he worked as a Pinkerton security cop in Atlanta. During my visits from college, he would drag me along with him on third shift. We would cruise by landing strips of warehouses into the horizon between us. In a loop-the-loop maneuver, he would peer out from a Ford LTD's window with an aviator's keen eye, looking for an enemy from the night sky, emerging from a bank of metal buildings, accelerating in North Korea, or from skies over Nam, with one hand at 12 o'clock. If he spotted a door ajar, he would hand me the flashlight and bark, "Check it out, Jocko." I would moan, half asleep and alert to the danger, hop out entering darkness, ready to love him with light shaking, exploring impenetrable places to check for what still might be there. I might spot men sleeping, smell cheap liquor, probably former Pinkertons or Marines, I thought. I'd close doors, report that it was all clear. My father would call me a good then say, "There's no assurances in this life."
I think that gets the book off because the first section is about family. You follow with the poem about your little brother, Tommy.
No, I think I have a mother and a grandfather poem in that section also.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It is in it starts out section two, poem about my mother and grandfather, Ring of Fire.
The one about your brother is one of those that just breaks me. And if you remember, it was actually one you had written later and you sent it to me. You said, does this belong in the book? And I'm like, oh, man, this poem has to be there.
In a raft of verses, to gain a father's praise, you try and fail perfection. You obey without question, but it's never enough. You have to be a sacrifice. I mean, man, that's pretty raw.
You know, that's why I go back to, you know, sometimes I think Ed wrote me once, you know, stay in the hunt. You know, stay, look, you know, search your feelings. And, you know, that's why, you know, it's like I learned that I was not trying to pick the perfect word or the perfect phrase, because you can never do that. Perfect enough. You can never get that. But if you can get as close to an honest expression, then that's good enough.
It certainly rings true, and I don't want to be over dramatic, but phrases like that are heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. You're trying so darn hard, and nothing's ever good enough. Have you really come to grips with that now?
You know, it's part of, I think, in the process of writing this book, the question I asked myself, why couldn't I do this when Pat was alive? He would be so thrilled about it and so excited. And you know, I had a Walter and Ed, a sister who was a, you know, is a fantastic poet, a brother who was just a wonderful writer, a wonderful novelist. And, you know, I always sort of just put all that feeling inside me on hold and just thought, that's not going to be me. That's not who I can't. You know, I can't follow that path, and I went into a professional journey to be as good as I could that way. But then, you know, really, Pat always encouraged me to write, always encouraged me when I sent him the odd poem every once in a while. He would always give me lots of encouragement. My regret is I didn't do this book when he was alive. But my great happiness is that I was able to do it. And what I want to tell people that might be thinking about writing, find your conviction. Say to yourself, you can do it. Read as much as you can. Write as much as you can. And just follow that conviction to emerge as a writer, if that's what you feel.
Have you been in touch with your sister, the poet?
Walter, my brother Mike, bought her a book. I signed it to her and sent the book to New York. She wrote me a beautiful card back, and she loved the book.
So you've been able to open up a connection that Pat was not able to.
And that's maybe the thing in this book that I tried to do symbolically, is with the two poems that sort of open the book, the Kafafi poem and the Mislav poem. You know, I really see the Kafafi poem as Pat's poem. Pat and Carol used to tease each other all the time about the poem, and I'll read a little excerpt of it.
All right, which poem are you talking about?
It's the
epigraphs.
Epigraphs. And they used to, in high school, would say, you know, to each other, who's going to say the great yes, who's going to say the no? And the poem starts out, to certain people, there comes a day when they must say the great yes or the great no. He who has the yes ready within him reveals himself at once, and saying it, he crosses over to the path of honor and his own conviction. Well, they would tease each other all the time about who was going to have the courage to say yes. And they both said yes. They both said it. I said no and no and no again and again. And to the great surprise of my life is you can say the great yes later. You can find that conviction. The other quote in there is something that my sister Carol, the Mislav quote, "Send your second soul beyond the mountains, beyond time. Tell me what you saw. I will wait." That appeared in her poetry book, The Beauty Wars. So to me, I have Pat and Carol on the same page, reunited in this book.
I'm glad you said yes. And Ed, let me ask you, because in some of your poetry, you did not have the best relationship with your father.
Right.
Did that ring a bell to begin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and actually the book that came out of mine last year was about taking care of my dad when he was dying of cancer and what all kinds of – I mean, it's a book about his dying, but it was also a book in some ways about a kind of healing. And I can't help but think of that kind of theme in Tim's book because, I mean, Tim's talking about the great yes, but I'm also thinking of the small yeses all through the end of the book. I mean, he has a poem called Ode to a Mender. So there are all these images of people doing small things to make relationships work. There's another poem about a daughter taking care of her mother, and she rubs lotion on the mother's nose, and then she remembers to rub the lotion on the same spot on hers. So it's this moment of care, but it's also this moment of connection. And there's a lot of that, particularly, I think, in the last section of Tim's book. But yeah, his poems rang true for me in many ways as well.
Okay.
This is why the Muddy Ford Press, boutique presses are so important because they allow the emerging writer to have a vehicle to get out there. The Laureate series, I think, is going to be incredible because it's going to allow another person like me to work with an established great poet. And so I really salute Cindy Boiter and Robert Jolly for starting this series.
This press is based in where?
In Columbia.
In Columbia.
Yeah.
Okay. And the state, Marjorie Wentworth, is still our state poet.
Yes, she is.
Poet laureate. Mm-hmm. And you said Charleston has a poet laureate?
Charleston has a poet laureate, Marcus Amaker. I know that Greenville and Spartanburg are working on one as well.
So then this could be, as you say, a series with all of those.
Right. I think that's the press's goal is to ask other poets laureate, state or city level, to do the same kind of project, to work with an unpublished, an emerging poet to get their voice in print as well.
Okay. Gentlemen, we have to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Ed Madden and Tim Conroy about Tim's book, Theologies of Terrain. Before we return to our conversation with Ed Madden and Tim Conroy, let's listen to an excerpt from a program from 2014 with Tim and his siblings, Pat, Kathy, Mike, and Jim. Here, Tim talks about reading Pat Conroy's book, The Death of Santini, and about the effect of Pat's writing on the Conroy family.
Oh, I was just going to say, reading The Death of Santini was like beating myself up with a lead pipe for every page. It was a tough read. My wife and I usually read Pat's books out loud to each other because we don't want to be finished before the other. So we won't, you know. So we usually take the time and read it to each other. And I tried to do this. We tried to do this with The Death of Santini, but my wife Terry was crying so much that I could not get through. And it's a tough book. It's redemptive, but it's tough. It's been a journey with all of my brothers and sisters. And really, I think because of Pat's writing and his work, it allowed us to have truth and illumination of sort of the pain and suffering we went through. And it has proven to me just redemptive. His work has helped us. It's brought us closer. It's made us stronger. And when you read his work, all of them, from his fiction to his nonfiction, he always exposes the truth.
That was Tim Conroy in an excerpt from a program we recorded in 2014 with his siblings Pat, Kathy, Mike, and Jim. And now, back to my recent conversation with Ed Madden and Tim Conroy about Tim's new book of poetry, Theologies of Terrain. Ed, in your introduction, you selected one poem that gripped you more than any others.
Right, Marsh Deer, yeah.
Yeah. So why don't you read that one?
Okay. Be honored. Marsh Deer. They pratfall a journey between twisted scrub oaks, part the blades of saw palmettos, glide through the last dry tickle of bristlegrass and foxtail. More like a string of hooved prayer beads giving thanks to the wilds, their resolve, moss-draped, asks the dawn for its deepening, stands under its rose amber, a wonder. They tease the surf, it greets them, kissing with wide smiles and quick legs. They kick and circle the white-tailed mystery. What draws them to the white foam, to the promise of crossings? What makes any creature choose uncertain currents? Green turtle hatchlings, bull sharks circling in creeks, the bric-a-brac of shattered shells, translucent dreams, heart-shaped impressions disappearing on a declivitous shore. Lives are as fleeting as bird songs, as long as letting go.
You say, Tim, you don't go for the right word. Bric-a-brac. I know it's not just a Southern term, but we all grew up with folks who collected bric-a-brac. They call them different things in other parts of the world, the United States. But that image of the bric-a-brac of shattered shells, that collection of shattered shells.
You know, to the emerging writer, that poem really started the roots of that poem from a workshop that Ed Madden was doing at the Richland Library.
I did not know that.
And and it was part of I think you had a 3 or 4 day workshop with folks, or is
it... I did a one day a week for a month series one summer there. Yeah.
And so I attended maybe 2 or 3 of those, and that really started there from a writing sort of prompt that you had done. So,
Ed, would you call the last two lines? Would you still say a couplet?
Oh yeah, it's still a couplet. Okay. But more than that, I would just say it's gorgeous. And those last two lines are just gorgeous. Lives are as fleeting as bird songs, as long as letting go.
I'm actually at a loss for words in my reaction to some of these. I mean, I've read them all, you see, but then listening to you reading and now talking about it, and I had already underlined that concluding couplet, lives are as fleeting as bird songs, as long as letting go, and powerful man.
You know, Ed was a really genius editor at helping me end a poem. You know, sometimes I would overwrite and I would try too hard. But he was really great at guiding me at beginnings and endings and staying to the essence. No, you were. And I can't praise you enough because this book is so much better because you were the editor.
Well, it was such a pleasure to work with these poems.
Well, let's move on to the poem that is Theology of Terrain, because when I get the chance, I usually get off the interstate and I drive back roads of South Carolina, and you see the abandoned farmhouse, some cases clearly a sharecropper's shack, tumble down barn, tobacco barn. Not that many abandoned churches, but you do see some. And the old general store, and you just wonder, as you do through this poem, what life was once in that. Again, this is a line that really grabbed me, and it's about the dogs in the Delta, but this: the sniffing of the forgotten praise hymn of ruined field churches. Once those were places of joy and wonder, a praise house.
You know, this whole poem was inspired by two wonderful photographers, one of which is a professor at the University of South Carolina in the School of Visual Arts, Kathleen Robbins, and her book, Into the Flatland, photographs of the Mississippi Delta is just beautiful.
When she first came to Carolina, a number of her photographs hung in the hallway at Southern Studies.
And Walter, the cover of the book is a photograph from Into the Flatland.
Which one of you wants to read the poem?
No, Tim has to read it.
But it's a long poem, Walter. You want me to read a section?
Just read section one.
Can you read four, too? Four I love. Sorry, four is amazing. Read one and four.
Okay.
This poem is Theology of Terrain, inspired by the photography of Kathleen Robbins and Maud Schuler Clay. One, Delta dogs. Dogs in the Delta, howling a depth of field in rows of spent cotton, rambling, wailing travelers, sniffing the forgotten praise hymns of ruined field churches, more like specks and ruts, the foreground, the background, part of a theology of terrain, both genuflection to color and black and white timelessness, abandoned bridges, leaky barns, rusted lives, of faithful and forgotten owners, different seasons where same is not the same, yet a foregone conclusion. The Delta brings them into its depth across the mounds of the native dead. Their four-legged scope embraces the vastness of sky and soil, moonlit howls across muddy gorges, the virility of swamp hunts, smells of the earth's decay surround them. Delta dogs greet the dead, always ready to mark a homemade headstone. And I'm going to skip to four. Percy, 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 is that you? You're music to my soul. Damn, boy, I thought I'd lost you. Lift it up and let it go, boy. Mark a good one, Percy. I got to tell you some things. This Delta is alive, alive again. Foxes in the kudzu tangle, trains in the depot, barns, purpose, bridges, spanning, tractors, sweeping, all of us in fields, harvesting the vibrant blues of living. And the horizon, Percy, you don't have to chase it anymore. Wait on it to come to you. Wait like a man standing in a beanfield, Percy, shading his eyes to a vision, dogs all upon the Delta.
I wow. love that turn at the end where he addresses the dog or the ghost of the dog. I just love that.
These poems are based, as you said, on Kathleen's
Theology of Terrain is based on Kathleen and Maud's photography, and the Apertures poem is based on an event that happened after the flood at Kathleen's house.
Well, and that was one I wanted you to read because that's something not just Columbians, but people in a number of parts of the state after the 1,000-year flood had to experience. Let's do Apertures now.
Apertures. In a soft composition of rain, then an outpouring of grand expanse, rising to the hackberry, overwhelming the new deck, we fled 1,000 years. When floodwaters recede, the flesh of home sullied and sick, we focus lenses to memories, cross thresholds as shadow and light. See the demarcation of chance, watermarks on walls above the ruin of below, bone-dry oystermen in savanna, wet muck on fresh and loved faces, emulsion-peeling layers of occasion from photos not worth another word, toss albums into dumpsters, curse cameras from unlivable spaces, their apertures fixed to fate. Was it ever real? Our trip to Italy? The wedding on the beach at Edisto, stubbornly adhering to each other, no longer salvageable.
All right. This is a very particular reference because you live next door to Kathleen Robbins?
I live across the street.
Across the street. And did you get flooded as well?
We were okay. You know, a lot of the houses, we're pretty high up, but some of the basements in our neighborhood were flooded significantly. But of course, we all in Columbia had dear friends who were flooded.
She got flooded. Is that correct?
She did not. Her house was okay. Her basement got some water. But what she did was she recognized people. She's an expert at photography restoration. And she realized that people's houses that had been flooded, a lot of the things that had been ruined were photographs. And so she organized an attempt to rescue people's photographs, these precious memories of weddings, of events, of graduations, of mothers and fathers. And so people were dropping off boxes and boxes of muck-filled photographs, and she had organized a group of people to wash them, to damp dry them, to use hair dryers to try to dry them even more, and then she would wrap them up. If she saved them, she would wrap them up lovingly and beautifully in tissue paper and hand them back. And so, you know, I happened to be after the flood looking outside, and I saw car after car and woman after woman walk into Kathleen's house with blow dryers. And I said, what in the heck is going on? And so I walked over to the house and joined the effort. And it was an amazing effort. And what would happen sometimes after working on a photograph for 45 minutes, at the very end, you would see the emulsion start to peel and the photograph ruin. And, you know, what you thought you had saved was gone. Mm. So that poem kind of sprang out of that experience in Kathleen's effort.
This is one of several poems where you use a hackberry tree. And I just like hackberry trees. Most of my neighbors don't because they are messy trees. But they're an old-fashioned, really southern farmyard tree that you just don't see much anymore.
I like the way it sounds. You know, the sound of hackberry is just a great sound.
You know, you can make jelly from hackberries.
Is it good?
I don't know. I had an older neighbor who the late Julian Kennedy, who was fabulous neighbor, and she talked about, as a child in Barnwell, people had made jelly from hackberries. Couldn't do it from China berries, but China berries are only good for having a fight.
That's great.
So, Ed, I had an old-fashioned undergraduate education with Understanding Poetry by Robert Penwarren and those folks. This is free verse.
Mostly, although we talked a lot about meter, so some of them have a very regular, a very determined metrical beat to them, even if they look like free verse.
Oh, all right. I heard that in the reading, but I did, you know, when you first looked at that, and that's what I was just trying to figure out.
I think apertures definitely does.
Yeah.
I think when I first started to work on that, you saw the possibilities of even adhering more to a formal.
And that one is a kind of blank verse. It's pentameter. It's not all iambic, but it is unrhymed pentameter.
And then you get to no true root.
That was one of our six traffic ticket poems. So that was on traffic tickets all over downtown Columbia last spring.
Well, six lines.
Well, it also does Tim's great trick, which he does, I think, at the end of Apertures as well, which is he has a line of thinking going, and then suddenly at the end it opens out to another possibility, like in Apertures, that stubbornly adhering, no longer salvageable, could be as much about the couple's wedding as it could be about the pictures thereof. So this one does that same kind of little jump at the end. I love this one. But yeah, I'd love to read it. No true root. Merge or stop, left or right, departure or arrival. You need directions from strangers for inward destinations, too. I love that.
Looks like you've got another poem you want to read, Tim.
I was looking back at No True Route, but I'll read something.
Wait, you say route.
Root.
I like true root.
True root. Well, you know, there's a series of poems that I really was inspired to write by my wife, Terry, and the women in our lives. And so I would like to read Hens and Chicks. In this squirrel of trouble, turn to your inheritance, the clippings of sisterhood, grown in grief-watered soil, pap for the driest times, poised on pickets and tins, perched next to foundations on ledges in terracotta, clustering in tight-lipped resolve, rallying to you again and again, blooming and perishing, a descendancy of tough rosettes, the succulent hearts of kinswomen.
And for those who might not be gardeners and know about old-fashioned southern plants, hens and chicks are succulents which reproduce. You could take just a petal and you can start a whole nother plant. So that's where it's very easy to be a pass-along plant.
And they're called hens and chicks because the main mother plant will put out little ones all around itself and you pick those off.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny, Walter, we have hens and chicks have been passed down on her side of her family from her grandmother to mother to daughter. And, you know, it's a symbol to me of the love and the toughness of these women that have gone through so much together, loss and life and struggle. And that plant that has this history and this legacy, you know, subtle mm-hmm. little thing that sits on the edge of a deck and has history.
Well, see, that's a pass-along plant.
And you know, that's what I love. That's why I love that image of that plant. And, you know, it's definitely the women in my life have been so important to me. And especially my wife. I mean, without her and sort of the challenges that, you know, everybody goes through, not just me, but everybody. When you have somebody you love deeply that you can share those challenges with, it just makes things so much easier when bumps happen along the way. And when the wheels fall off, you have somebody that will help you put them back on.
We're getting the wind-up sign. Ed, I'm going to come to you for a last word.
I just want to say I loved working with this book. I loved working with Tim. And I just want to read the last two lines of the book because I think they're perfect for ending the book. Who have you loved in this journey? What is it you have given? I love that it ends on those two questions.
Ed Madden and Tim Conroy, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. What a great story. Tim Conroy, late in life, deciding that he really wants to be a poet. He gets linked up with Ed Madden, and the result of their collaboration is Tim's first book of poetry, Theologies of Terrain. It is southern to the core, but it reaches the human condition. And the last line in the book, I think, captures it all. Who have you loved in this journey? What is it you have given? This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal. Thank you. Next time on Walter Edgar's Journal, my guest will be internationally renowned journalist Robert Cox, and we'll be talking about his time as editor of the Buenos Aires Herald during the time of the disappeared.
I think I had a sense that I had a duty to do, quite honestly, now when I look back, to get the news out, because there was total silence in Argentina and these terrible things were happening and people refused to see what was happening. They refused to see people being taken off the streets. They refused to see these Ford Falcon cars with these thugs, real thugs, with their machine guns outside, yelling at people. People picked up, and there was a total silence. I realized then that if you ever live in a society where you can't go to your newspaper in the morning or listen to your radio station or see your television, the situation is changing now because of social media, which is interesting, but if you can see something and you know you... it's not very wise of you to intervene, and you wonder. And if you go back and there's no confirmation of what you've seen, you just don't see anything at all, and you see less and less and less.
Join me for Walter Edgar's Journal, a production of South Carolina Public Radio, Friday at noon.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.